We're rolling.
Well, welcome to episode 80. It's a big milestone for Panoramic Outdoors, and I'm going to introduce the boys here right away quick, but before I do, I got to do a huge shout out and special thanks to Kingfisher Boats. Kingfisher Boats helped us get our guest on, who, stay tuned because it's Tim Millen. He is one of their, you know, pros that runs one of these Kingfisher boats. They're started in 1959. They've got one of the best boats on the market. They've got over, I think it's like 33 hand-built models, and they're available all across North America. So if you want to get into a boat, check out kingfisherboats.com. They've got like that pre-flex hull technology where it's all seamless. It's a beautiful boat. Check them out, www.kingfisherboats.com. So, fellas, episode 80. I'm going to introduce Tristan here first because Chase is already laughing at me for this intro. So, Tristan, when you think of the number 80, what do you think of first?
Well, before we get to the number 80, I just want to say when you're on the lake and a Kingfisher passes you, you know that a Kingfisher boat has passed you.
They're beautiful.
I know. It's like a Cadillac on the water in some ways, I feel like.
Yeah, absolutely.
A Cadillac that works really hard. 80, man. Like every time we launch one podcast, never mind 80 podcasts, I feel like I can't believe that we're this far into the panoramic journey. So it's exciting to think of.
Yeah, for sure. When I was thinking of it today, I'm like, how are we gonna do this intro? How are we gonna like make it kind of cool about the number 80? And I couldn't think of anything other than 80s music. And then I started thinking about Michael Jackson and the song Thriller. So I didn't really want to go there. But Chase, what's going on over there? What do you think of when you hear episode number 80? What does that mean to you for a podcast platform? Like, we hit a pretty big goal. What have you, do you have any reflection on what number 1 to number 80?
Oh, man. I feel like I have high hopes that we've done our audience justice here and improved since episode 1. Greatly. I can recall some of the first episodes being pretty much more amateurish than we are now. But man, 80's a good number. I feel like we've worked our asses off to get here pretty much. This is we're talking about this week actually, how this company is, we're pretty much putting in full-time hours to kind of keep things growing and keep things going here. And you know, it's been a journey. And I tell you what, when we get to episode 100, I don't know about you guys, but I'm throwing a hell of a party.
Are you? That's awesome.
We'll probably be in Moose Camp or something like that for episode 100.
That'd be cool.
Be a party of three.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's pretty sweet. Tristan, how's Willie doing? I see he's growing up a little bit.
Oh man, like it's awesome. He's starting to get dialed in. He's super smart, super receptive to commands. We're getting kind of the recall, all that training's starting to come in. Been out with Graham working him. Super excited. Had him on pigeons. He got his first chicken point the other day when we were out shooting. Didn't find one shed. I'll be clear about that. But he got his first point on a chicken. I didn't get to see it. Carly saw it. He passed 5 chickens before he finally pointed the 6th one. But that 6th one he stretched out for. And man, what a thing to witness.
Yeah. Those dogs, no matter like their age, well, I guess I'll just go with it. No matter their age, it's pretty neat when they start to catch on to things. And like when they, you know, they start working. I know with our family, we've had like labs the whole time, so we never really had a pointing dog. But I remember our first dog, Zach, he was a purebred black lab, but he would actually point. And my dad never taught him how to do it. Like, wow. I don't know where it came from, but he would see something, a chicken or whatever, and he would point and he'd be stretched out. And it was quite amazing just like the things dogs can do, especially working type dogs.
That's wild, man. And the interesting thing about having an upland dog, because we had a lab in the past too, and Chase and I trained it, Remington there. And the big difference between I'm finding is that the upland dog is you're actually training it to hunt. Whereas the lab, you just kind of train to watch and pick it up, right?
Right.
The lab's picking up dead things, theoretically. Hopefully you're a good shot. the upland bird is you gotta have such a range of command over this thing, because it could be like when I was out with Graham, his dog can run a full section in like no time flat. So you need to be able to bring that thing back pretty quickly, right? Or a full quarter section, I should say. Anyways, that's my Willie update. Thanks for asking.
I just got one more question about Willie too. So when they're young, and maybe this is a question for Point Proven Kennels, but when they're young, are they generally like pointing at anything that's moving around, say in the grass or in the bushes, or are they kind of have that like bred into them that they're looking for a bird type figure, or do you know any of that?
I'm definitely not an upland expert. This is my first pointing dog, so let's just be clear on that. But I have witnessed Willie pointing several inanimate objects, like a pizza box and some other things. He's also pointing the geese that are in our backfield at about 50 to 60 yards. But yeah, the Little Caesars box on the floodway has been pointed a couple times, so we know it's there. It doesn't flush, but it's pretty dependable that way.
That's funny.
Yeah. So I had this thought that spring always used to feel like downtime for me. Like you would like kind of wind down a little, take stock of your fishing gear, maybe recharge some batteries and stuff like that. But I don't know if it's just having a family now and having a dog, but it seems just as busy as all those other seasons. Speaking of dog, like I've got stuff going in the garden. It seems like we could get out shed hunting. There's like some ice fishing for trout that you could still do. There's a spring goose season. We're prepping for turkey now. Like I feel like there's still a lot on the go. Like, what do you guys feel like?
Lost on the go. I haven't even started my garden stuff yet, just because I haven't felt motivated to yet. But I'm really looking forward to like turkey camp and maybe chasing after a black bear this spring. We'll see how things go, but I'm definitely looking for every opportunity I can to get back outside here. Sheldon?
Yeah, same here. Like I'm kind of feeling the same thing as Tristan, other than I don't have a dog and a family, but I've been slammed with certain parts in my career that things are kind of taking a backseat to my weekends and getting out shed hunting and doing all this stuff. But I'm actually, you know, I was getting into that mood where I'm like, fuck yeah, spring's here. Let's start, you know, barbecuing, being outside, doing all this. And then like Mother Nature is like, hold my beer. Here's a fucking snowstorm for you guys. And then now we're back to like that life of everything's wet and dirty and muddy and everything else again. But yeah, I'm just about there, I guess.
Yeah. The typical Manitoba snowstorm, man. Looks like some good weather in the forecast. So I am excited about that. I loaded up on charcoal for the pit barrel. So, you know, there was a huge charcoal shortage last summer going into the fall. And I got my hands on a couple bags anyway for the next foreseeable future. So we're still working that sucker heavy. We actually got a video coming out on YouTube right away on the pit barrel. Not sure if we're going to launch that one today on the same day we're launching this, or if we're going to launch it in the future, but you guys can keep an eye out for that. We do a little ice fishing excursion with it. Check it out. If you guys aren't familiar, Pit Barrel Cookers are a huge supporter of this podcast, and we've been using them for almost a year now. And if you want to step up your flavor game on your barbecue, your smoker, and your charcoal, it's a super easy platform to use, a super easy unit to use, and it will bring anything that you cook in there, the flavor, to the next level. So check them out, pitbarrelcookers.com, and in the United States, free shipping in Canada. Head over to the website, and you can check out the map where all the available dealers are in Canada. So that's pitbarrelcookers.com.
You said something that was very interesting to me, that we're going to be launching our YouTube channel. Anybody that listens to the podcast, go over to YouTube, check us out, subscribe. We're going to be trying to drop videos, you know, two, three, four videos a month of some of the cooking experiences, outdoor experiences, hunting, fishing, whatever we can do to create content. We've already got a few videos on there. So if you have nothing better to do, go on YouTube and you start looking around. Type us into the search bar, Panoramic Outdoors, and you should be able to find our videos. Speaking of that, though, I also want to say kind of thank you to everyone that joined us in the big giveaway. Tristan and Chase did a great job putting that together and giving away a bunch of stuff from some of our current and previous sponsors that we've had. So it was a wicked giveaway. It was over $700 worth of stuff and one lucky winner. So hopefully they get to enjoy some of the stuff we've been enjoying for the last little while. And I'd like to apologize too on the behalf of Panoramic to all the accounts that got messages from spammers or people that are trying to scam you. Anything in the future, we would never ask for credit card information or personal information, really. But that being said, the podcast has been rated in Japan and Germany. I think I mentioned that last time, but it's still holding strong in the top 200 in each respective place. So that's really, really interesting. And anybody that's listening to the podcast currently, wherever you live, please give us a rating. Leave us a comment. Share it with your friends and family, because every time that happens, it helps us grow and helps us get some wicked guests like Tim Millen that's coming here shortly.
Yeah, that giveaway was probably the most fun that I had all month. It was a lot of work, for sure, compiling all the names. 981 entries, but it was like when Chase and I got down to like doing the draw, it was like physically exciting to be involved in that. So that was kind of cool. For sure.
Yeah, that is sweet.
What are you guys thinking? I'm curious what your thoughts are around this. But, you know, like we said earlier, spring is kind of in the air here. And I don't know what's going to happen with COVID, but I'm always excited when spring rolls around. That sun starts warming stuff up. And it gets me thinking, like, archery, obviously spring hunting. But, like, one thing that I really want to do this summer is put together some sort of get together, either an archery shoot or like a shore fishing session or something like that.
I was thinking about this the other day driving, and I was like, fuck man, how fun would it be to go golfing? Because I would pay money to Chase to watch you play 18 holes of golf with like a case of beer. I think it would be like probably the funniest days of the summer. But yeah, I totally agree. I think we should totally do something. And actually, a guy reached out to me that was at our event that we did in Nipawa with Josh there a couple summers ago. And he reached out and asked if we were planning on doing something. If we ever do it again, he said him and his wife are 100% in. They had a blast last time, apparently. So that's pretty cool.
Man, that's fun to think of, because Nipawa has been good to us. That ice fishing getaway that we did on Lake Winnipeg 2 years ago was super fun, or a year and a half ago, whatever it would be. And then as Chase identified, even like a shore fish or something could be super, super fun.
Yeah, I'm totally pumped to put something together. I'm 100% in if COVID will ever let us do something.
Yeah. Maybe if McFads will give up his secret spot, we can all go raid it.
Who would want to hang out? We could lock portal. Speaking of other Instagram people, have you guys checked out what April's doing on Instagram?
The big shed hut excursion? Is that what you're referring to there, Sheldon?
I don't have it up in front of me, but we are supporting it. And it's like kind of just like a fun get outside. I think it's April. I'll look it up maybe here in a second. But I think it's like April 17th weekend, and it's free. All you got to do is just go out and shed hunt with whoever you want. Take some pictures and use the hashtags that she says. And they're going to have some like people judging the pictures. So it doesn't matter if you find like a little four corn shed, or you find a massive 6x6 shed or a deadhead. It doesn't matter. Take a picture of it. It gets people involved, and there's like wicked prizes, like ones from us. There's prizes from Hunt Fish Manitoba. There's prizes from Joe Brook, Danny's Whole Hog. So for a free event, I think it's really cool what she's doing, and I hope a lot of people are going to participate.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome too. It's a great way to for folks to get outside and do something that's fun, that they love. Not only are you shed hunting, but you're scouting a new area, if you're in a new area or an old area, wherever you're at. And you're just getting outdoors and with the chance to win some stuff.
Here's a question for you, both of you guys. If you guys go and take a day shed hunting, what's something that you take with you that maybe the other person might not think about?
Good question.
I don't have input into that, but I'll tell you what happened to me when I was shed hunting this past weekend when I brought Willie out. Not only did I find zero sheds and walk through some of the thickest bush in our area that is probably there, with zero results, I also walked past one of our tree stands, and there was a few old drag lines still hanging in the stand or the stand site. So I scooped them up and put them in my hoodie. And then we did the whole lap there and went looking for chickens and saw Willie Point, and then got home, threw all my clothes in the wash. And the next day, Carly comes up and she's like, "Where are these strings from?" And I just kind of like had like my mouth agape, and I was like, I was trying to figure out if I wanted to disclose that it had like synthetic deer urine on it, or if, and I was just going to say, "Oh, it's just some hunting thing. Don't worry about it." But, yeah, I came clean. So she wasn't too thrilled about that.
There's a few things that I'm always packing with me when I'm going through the bush, like obviously water and stuff, but I always tend to, especially if you're going on public lands, I guess it really doesn't matter where you're going, but I always put a little garbage bag, little black garbage bag or white garbage bag in my pocket or whatever, just because I find a lot of like trailheads and stuff always have garbage or something. If you can do just that little bit by cleaning up what you see, there's no point of walking by it, right? So just a quick little tip. People appreciate it, and I mean, people shouldn't be littering anyways, but that's what I do.
That's a great tip, man. That's a great way to keep, leave stuff a little bit better than the way you found it, really. I don't know if I have one better than that. I think my focus for like the next little while here, getting out in the woods, is going to be like, how can I get out there, but how can I cook up a little awesome meal while I'm out on the land? You know what I mean? Whether that's right. Over a little campfire or over a cook stove or whatever it may be, if it's just like a quick soup and sandwich or something more elaborate than that. I think I'm just going to start incorporating a little meal into the adventure whenever I can now.
You know what the other cool thing is about kind of evolving your outdoor repertoire here too, is when I was out shed hunting, I noticed that there was some old chanterelles on the ground just because of like all the like mushroom picking you guys and Josh have done. I was like, so I marked it in my iHunter app. I was like, huh, that's a mushroom site. I better mark that. And so like, I mean, it seems like it's all starting to blend together a little bit more now. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's cool, man. Like, and I was like, I never did any of that per se, but like even when I was out in the deer woods and I was shed hunting there a couple weekends ago, and you started like hiking down some of these trails and like checking out spots where you, like, I've never really been, but I know, like, knew it was there kind of idea. And I started like almost getting that itch. Like, I can't wait to go deer hunting. And like, I found some spots where I'm like, oh, this is where the deer are coming from. Cause like, there's certain stands that I sit in that I know where they're going to be like appearing from through the bush, but I don't know exactly where they're coming from. So I got to kind of like almost like backtrack on their trails to see, you know, I found a couple different bedding areas I didn't know was there. So it's like, it's really cool. And I should have started marking some of that stuff on the iHunter app, but I never even thought about it. But it is cool, the stuff that you, when you start connecting, and I know it's very cliche, but when you do connect with nature, you start, you know, picking up on a lot of things that you'd never even knew about or never noticed.
Pretty sweet, man. Pretty sweet. Oh man, one cool thing about that area you're in, Tristan, was like this fall, I kind of messed up because when I was deer hunting in there, there's like a ton of honey mushrooms or what the heck, dude? What's the other name for them? Papanky is the other name. But when I went out there, they were all froze up because it frosted the night before. So it's one hot spot for them out there. But I am looking forward to getting into the old mushroom woods this year. It's funny having to talk about mushrooms and deer hunting and all that. I remember when we were elk hunting last fall, and last year was like the first real year I did a lot of mushroom hunting. And I remember we're like chasing a bugling elk, and I was like kind of looking at the ground just to make sure I wasn't stepping on any branches or anything. And of course, there's a couple mushrooms on the ground. And like the first thing that pops into my head was like, fuck, I wonder if I can eat those ones. And so I kind of like take a look at them. And I'm like, focus, bugling bull, let's go.
I don't know about this story because there's a few things that I need to point out to anybody that's listening. And that's believing what Chase is saying. Is that first of all, he is correct. He's always looking at the ground and like picking up mushrooms in the middle of a pursuit. But he does not look to where he's stepping on sticks because he's got to be one of the loudest people in the bush that I've walked through with. And Chase is laughing because he knows it's true. But I think that story's about there's a few little glitches in there that I must correct.
Chase, are you going to be the Randy Newberg of mushroom picking? Like kind of like he is with grouse?
I could be. I'd rather it be a grouse, I think, but good old mushroom would be good too.
Good old mushroom. Oh, that's good. Yeah, I can't wait to start doing some of that stuff again.
One more thing I wanted to mention in this intro before we got into the main production is, what the hell is that noise? Sounds like a duck. Anyways, have you guys watched The Sleepy Story by Cody and Kelsey Robbins?
I have, yeah.
Tell me what you thought of it, quick. Give me 10 seconds on what you think it is all about.
Oh, 10 seconds of what I think it's all about, man. I've never really manufactured a relationship with a deer like Cody has there. It's really interesting to see like the years of commitment that kind of went into that deer. You know, it's all part of a bigger perspective for the most part, but towards the end he was obviously very focused on that particular animal. And man, I could only put myself in his boots and like just by my imagination to think about the emotions that were running through his head when he arrowed that thing. And it was just, I don't know, it's pretty unbelievable. I don't know if I'd be happy or sad or what I would feel in that moment. A lot of both, I think. And man, yeah, that's all I got to say on it.
Tristan, did you watch that at all?
No, you never did, eh?
Excuse me. My big thing there for me is like I watched the entire thing and I was like hooked into it. Like it wasn't like a video on Wild TV. It was, what was it, like 2 hours? Or I can't remember what the length of that was, Chase. I don't know if you recall either.
Yeah, it's pretty long. It was more like a documentary style kind of film.
But like it was very, very raw. And the thing that I took away from it is that like Cody Robbins and his whole crew with cameraman Richie and his wife and his family and all his friends and everybody that kind of has a little bit to the story, like hats off to them. But I've never experienced anything like that of any caliber. Like, yeah, I get some trail cam pictures of some bucks and I, you know, will text you guys and be like, oh, new target buck acquired, but then you might not ever see it or you might see it only on camera. But I've never experienced the fact of watching a deer grow like that. I've never experienced so many things where when I was watching it, I was just hooked. I was just like, man, this is very interesting. And not only that, they didn't edit out like the shit that happened, right? Like the times they missed or the, you know, the days they took off from hunting that particular deer and went after whitetail for a day. Like they didn't cut out all the riffraff. They put it together in a very thoughtful way where it's got to be hands down one of the best hunting videos or documentaries that I've ever watched. I'll put that in the top three for sure.
Yeah. No, it was really well put together. There's some raw footage in there that is like you won't see in lots of other videos. Like I remember one of the misses Cody had and he took a shot at the deer in the wind and you can just see the arrow like blow almost completely sideways in the film. And like my thought was just like, oh my God, that's wild. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
And it's like, it's kind of vulnerable for him. Cause like I think he could take a lot of criticism for that, but I guarantee you 10 times out of 10, I'd be taking that shot every time. And you know, shit happens. Right.
Yeah. And like, yeah, of course he might take some criticism. And that was the other thing I was going to mention. There's parts in there when he gets super emotional on different things. Right. And like, I just think about if that was me in his foot and like in his shoes, how I'd be like, no, you got to edit that out. No one's going to watch me cry on video, you know, or something. But like, he legit just let it ride. Like, he let the video, like, I don't know. He just let it happen for the video, right? It's just, yeah, it's really cool. So if anybody's looking to watch it, do you know where you can find it?
It's on Vimeo.
Right. So you can just go in there and search in the Sleepy Story, I believe, or you probably just type in Sleepy and it'll pop up. And if not, send us a message and we can link you up with or give you the information where you can find it or wherever else.
Yeah. One other cool thing I want to just plug here before we take off to the podcast, speaking about videos and films, check out the hunting film tour. That is on being held by the Manitoba Wildlife Federation right now. So if you go over to their website or on Instagram, their link tree, that's the link in the bio. And it's a free ticket, and it's the it's like a film tour style video, and it's got everything from elk hunting, bighorn sheep hunting, upland game hunting, and moose hunting on there. So some really great films. Check them out, and it's worth a watch. Huntingfilmtour.com.
There you have it. Well, I think it's about time we bring on the meat and potatoes to the podcast, like a lot of people have heard me say before. If you guys are all good with it, I think what we should do is queue up the Tim Millen podcast. Again, big thanks to Kingfisher Boats. This is a good podcast. It's all about the West Coast fishing and just kind of like a little bit of the lifestyle of Tim Millen. Enjoy. So today's guest, he's the host of Big Coast, the TV show that on for over a decade. Welcome to the show, Tim Millen.
Thanks a lot. Good to see you guys.
Right on. So me and Chase are here tonight. We're going to be doing this podcast episode. And how we start normally is we ask our guests five burning questions. I'm going to put you on the spot here on a few of them. And a few of them you're probably going to hit out of the park. But it's just for our guests to kind of get to know you as well before we get into the main framework of the conversations. So my number one question is, if you weren't an angler, what would you be doing today?
Well, I'm also a snowboarder, so I'd probably be snowboarding.
Oh, that's an awesome alternate for sure.
Good answer.
Yeah, perfect answer. You do a lot of time. You spend a lot of time in your boat. What is the best boat snack?
The best boat snack. I mean, a lot of my friends would say it's Budweiser. And you know, those that go deeper than that would go Budweiser and potato chips probably. So yeah, we'll leave it at that.
That's a good combination. My number three question is, if you're sitting by the fire relaxing and you got some music playing on the back in the background, what would you be listening to?
Just about anything. I like a lot of diverse tunes. We got to spend a lot of time on the boat, over the course of the summer. So, man, you're listening to everything from old 60s, 70s Grateful Dead to speed metal to wake you up to, man, you name it, a little bit of everything. The reggae comes out when it's sunny, and the classic rock comes out with the Budweisers and potato chips around happy hour.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm super jealous, and I'm looking forward to summer now. Number four, if you had any type of phobia, if you're scared of anything, is there anything that comes to mind?
Fears. You know what? I spent a lot of time in the mountains, a lot of backcountry, a lot of years on a snowboard. So I gained some pretty serious appreciation for Mother Nature and that big mountain environment. And the same thing holds true with everything we do on the ocean. The salt water and big ocean will step up and kick your ass. So if you don't respect it, that's what I fear. There's certain situations and places we're in or we have to pay respect to that are, you know, your life's at risk if you don't do it right. So it's a Mother Nature question for sure. That's what I fear. No man, but I fear the planet. Yeah.
That's an awesome answer. I would totally agree with you. I probably an ant in your world kind of thing, but there's odd times when I'm in a mile by mile bush and I get kind of not scared, but, you know, start double thinking things where I'm at. And I could just imagine the big ocean or the mountainside. My fifth question is, if you won just enough money to buy your dream boat and you had to buy it with that money, what would you buy?
Well, it'd be a big yacht, so that'd have to be a pretty big win, you know? We fish on a pretty nice 30-foot kingfisher, you know, that's perfect for coastal fishing. My next step up would be something in the, 70 to 80 foot Hatteras class that I could fish marlin and live down in the Bahamas on.
That's pretty sweet.
That's awesome.
My question to that one would be, is there any stipulation that a guy can buy this so-called boat and possibly sell it in a year and reap some benefits and spread the wealth around?
Well, right on. You made it through the five burning questions. It was kind of a breeze for you, I think, there, Tim. So I guess we might as well get into the meat and potatoes of the podcast. I guess first things first is I just kind of want to ask, a lot of us, outdoors people, we often dream about having that career. It might be, hunting, fishing, or camping, or doing whatever it is outside. How did that come into fruition, and where are you at now? Like, how did that all start for you, and how did it, how'd that path go?
It's a bit of a weird story. It's not a conventional path that I think anyone else has followed, but we've had a production company for 25 years now. And I got my start doing the snowboard and action sport thing a long time ago. So we did all the World Cup snowboard and mountain bike production for Outdoor Life Network and CTV and what have you for a long time. We did a backcountry snowboarding show called Sacred Ride, which was all heli skiing and jumping out of helicopters and stuff like that. But I've fished my entire life and hunted the same thing. So, I had an opportunity about 15 years ago to put those two passions together, our production and expertise on the communication side with a love for fishing. And that's really where it all started.
Yeah, right on. And was there anybody that kind of like pushed you in the direction of the fishing, or did it kind of just, did you have any mentors growing up, or how'd that go?
Yeah, I think like most of us, my old man was a pretty hardcore fisherman and taught me everything when I was young. And I grew up with a dock in my backyard fishing bass when I was 6 years old and had my own tinner boat and the freedom to get places. And, ironically, I'm doing the same thing now, just on a slightly larger scale. So my father-in-law as well is a pretty salty West Coast fisherman here. So I learned a lot from the old guys, and I give them credit for getting me so enthused and involved in the fishing side of things.
That's awesome. Do you have a little bit of history back east too on the waters here, Tim?
Yeah, it's I actually grew up in North Bay, Ontario. So that dock I'm talking about was way up north, and I fished bass and pike and muskie and all that starting out. I got lucky when I was 19 or 20. I hooked up with a flight attendant, and she was a Delta girl here in Vancouver. And, we've been married for a long time now, but we made the move west shortly after that. And I never looked back, and I've been fishing West Coast since. So a little bit of Eastern history, but it's far removed at this point.
Yeah, it's pretty, I would imagine it'd be pretty tough to come back.
The other thing that kind of interests me there is that you did say you got into snowboarding. You are a snowboarder. You do a lot of time in the mountains. So like, did you do that back home in Ontario, or was that something that you picked up when you moved out west and you just kind of ran with it?
No, I've always been on skis or a snowboard. I mean, nice. Skied for a long time before there was even snowboarding, right? So, I was lucky. The things I still do today, ski, snowboard, fish, they're all the things I did when I was a kid. So I'm pretty fortunate to have had these passions that I've been able to follow my whole life. And, the snowboard thing got crazy there for a bunch of years. We lived it hard, and I coached the national team for a few years, Vancouver 2010 at the Olympics. I coached the snowboard cross team. So we won the first ever gold medal for a Canadian female. It was Mile Ricker in the border cross, and won a couple medals there. And as soon as we were done, I had one more trip to Spain and Italy, and we partied down, and I retired from that stuff and went straight to fishing full time.
Awesome. And then, and the other thing I want to talk about, you kind of mentioned it, was the Kingfisher boat. And you are, I don't know, maybe you can go through your relationship you have with Kingfisher and maybe some stuff about that boat. I was looking online and they've got just a wicked lineup. And not only that, but like I watched a YouTube video, I believe, of yours, and kind of they went through like a walkthrough of a boat. And it's quite the machine. I mean, we don't see them that big here in Manitoba, let's say, but what's the benefits to going with that Kingfisher?
Well, they're designed for the West Coast. If you're out there like we are in the environment all the time, man, it's rainy so much. Like up on the North Coast in Prince Rupert and the Great Bear Rainforest, we're dealing with a lot of nasty weather. It's certainly not all sunny trolling. So with all our camera gear and crap we have to haul around all the time, you need a covered boat where you can, fire up your diesel heater and keep everything dried out and what have you. Plus, we got to sleep on it sometimes. We're not always in port. We're dropping anchor all over the place and what have you. So, you know, Kingfisher was one of the early adopters of the aluminum West Coast boat, probably 15 years ago, right when we were starting the series, they were coming out with those first models. So I've been fortunate to be with them for kind of the whole run of these things. And we got one of the newer 30 footers right now, and that's what we've been rocking the last 2 or 3 years.
Nice. And what's pushing that thing along, hitting the waves? What kind of motors do you got on that thing?
We roll that twin Yamaha F200s on it. Now you can roll 250s and maybe eke another 5 miles an hour out. But a lot of the stuff I do is fuel range dependent. We run the inside passage all the way up to Prince Rupert. That's the entire BC coast. And then come fall, we're tuna fishing all the time. So we're going anywhere from 50 to 100 miles offshore of the west coast of Vancouver Island. And you need to have the fuel capacity to get your ass back to shore when you're done. So those four-cylinder F200s, they burn a little less fuel. They're a little lighter and a little more economical. The boat still tops out 42, 43 miles an hour. So that's what we run, but there's a good reason for it.
That is a haul out to sea in like the 30-footer, man. Shit.
100 miles offshore is an entirely different world, man. Most people aren't built for it. It took us a long time to get our skills to the level where we're comfortable. There's a whole bunch of fishermen on the west coast of Vancouver Island that have got into the tuna thing in the last few years especially, but it goes back as far as 10. We've been doing it. And it's a different beast, most certainly.
No kidding. I'm interested. What kind of like there's obviously the ocean, like you said, can be a very vicious animal at times. And like in my mind, we live right beside Lake Winnipeg here, and it's the biggest body of water, Manitoba, and it can have its days too. And like us traveling out in the 18-foot Lund, you know, some days most days you're just not doing it because like a 20-kilometer-an-hour wind here is going to be pushing waves bigger than you want to be traveling out there. And what are your kind of limitations for headed out 100 miles into sea with that with your boat?
You know, in some regards, they're the same as they would be on Lake Winnipeg. You know, you really have to check the weather conditions. It can blow up on you at any time. Wind is crucial, but probably just as important as swell. So you wouldn't have that, but we get the West Coast swell. So you're always checking, you know, if you're 1 to 2 meter, it's go time, but anything more than that, if you start getting 3 meter plus swell, that's up to 20 foot waves. And we don't like being out in that stuff for sure. So you have to be really cautious about the conditions. It's really well measured, and usually there's a bunch of boats. So you have at least a buddy boat or two, so you're not way out there alone. But it's different. We'll go overnight too on those big trips. So we'll actually stay out there overnight, fish 2 days, and then come back to save on the fuel.
That's intense. I bet you it's got to be a totally different feeling being out there and just, it's got to be pretty quiet at times, but it's got to be pretty awesome after, having a great trip out that way.
For sure. The first couple of times we did it, it scared the hell out of us. You know, even though we were in perfect flat water and safe conditions and in good communication with people, but over the years we've certainly gotten more comfortable doing it, and we got a pretty good routine down. So we do everything safety. We got survival suits and EPIRBs and everything you can imagine in case we run into trouble. So it's a well measured deal, but it's way out there for sure. 100 miles offshore is a different world.
Yeah, big time.
Before I ask this question, I just want you to know, like, the only time I've spent time at a coast in reality was probably like in the Hudson Bay, Churchill. So I didn't get to do much boating and stuff. So can you explain to me like what a swell is and like what determines the sizes of swell and stuff like that?
Sure. I mean, we have to check our weather forecasts all the time. Environment Canada puts out swell and wind warnings. So swell is basically just the waves coming in off the west coast. In certain places, you don't get them. If you're on the inside of Vancouver Island, let's say, there's no swell. Vancouver Island shelters you from what is the bigger swell. And that can roll straight from Japan. It's only in the wide open ocean. So there's a whole bunch of factors involved in that swell, from your tides to your lunar phase and your moons and what have you. And they're way bigger in the winter than they are in the summer. So we look for certain windows and a certain amount of tide. And those swells we have to watch too. If they get too tight, there's actually a period for the swell as well. So if you're going out in them through your boat and the swells are really close, you wind up pounding them. If they're spaced wider apart, you can actually roll them over really easily. So it's there's a whole bunch of factors involved, but that's definitely part of the art and science of getting out there.
Those swells kind of rolling around in a series of three, two. Is that a thing, or is that just something I made up?
I think surfers have some ideas there, you know, that there's, you know, sets of seven waves or what have you. Everybody's got a take on it, man. I don't know. they're all over the place sometimes. And then like there's rogue waves that come in on some of those sets too, that nobody would guess. And I mean, a few years ago back in Tofino, there was a whale watching boat. I don't know if you guys remember the incident, but it got taken out by a big rogue wave and what would be some normal swell. And I think there was five or six fatalities. I can't remember, but all sorts of issues. And it just took the boat down. So there's that's why we really have to operate within a margin of safety with those conditions, because they can peak up at any time, even what's not predicted, right? So it's big and wild for sure.
Yeah. How are you guys, when you guys overnight 100 miles offshore, how are you guys like set up for the night? Like, is there, obviously you're not anchoring out there. Do you guys just kind of free float and see where you're at in the morning kind of thing?
Pretty much. Yeah. You're typically in 1500 to 2000 feet of water where we are. So you're not going to anchor. That'd be challenging. We have a couple things we use. One's a sea anchor, which we'll throw out on the surface, and it basically just slows the drift of the boat down. It's like a big parachute that mm-hmm. you drag bow, and it'll keep you oriented into the wind. Then we got a bunch of safety systems like AIS on the boat. So we're tracking, we set alarms up. Anybody comes within a 5 mile radius of the boat or what have you, the alarms go off, because there's big shipping out there and freighters and stuff that blow by. So if you didn't have the alarms and stuff, you'd never get to sleep. And we try to get a few Z's when they're out there. So there's a whole bunch of electronics that are working for you. And then we use an anchor that basically slows us down. I think last year we only rolled 4 or 5 miles over a course of a 7 or 8 hour night, which we actually slept right through, which is uncommon.
Nice.
Previous year without that wind anchor, I believe we rolled just under 20 miles. So we traveled about 18 miles overnight when we were asleep. And you just see it all in your chart and everything in the morning when you check it out. So
wow,
it's interesting.
It's a big difference. I think that's got to be similar to like a drift sock that we use here.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, same as the lake application, right? Just to slow the boat down or what have you.
Right on. And so I guess like the other thing too, I kind of want to pick your brain about, and I know it's kind of been a lot of Q&A and the conversation has been going pretty well actually, but I really want to know, you know, maybe some, how can I frame this properly? Maybe just some insider information. So if let's just say I was looking to book, you know, or looking to go get out to the West Coast to go and go and fish with somebody or, you know, hire somebody, what are some of the like do's and don'ts? Like, do you have anything that kind of just pops off on the top of your head of, you know, maybe some sketch businesses to stay away from? Like, you don't have to name them by any means, but stuff that you can look for.
I mean, the one good thing is the BC coast is full of super solid, reputable guides. There is a ton of real quality fishermen that come from fishing families, guys that have done it a long time. And like you said, though, there's jokers out there too that you want to avoid. So typically those guys aren't, you know, advertising the same way or don't carry the same profile. So I think it's relatively easy to sort out the bigger operators, and the bigger operators largely, they've been around for a while. They're all quality operations, right? But you do get some smaller ones that are fly by night guys that, you know, maybe aren't as certified. They don't have all their tidal angling stuff in order or what have you. They're doing it on the cheap. And that does occur, not that often, fortunately, but so one bonus there is there's a lot of quality guides in that regards. I think probably more importantly is the time of year, the type of fish you want to catch, and what your comfort level is with the ocean, right? Like I was saying, that the west coast of Vancouver Island is going to put you in some sloppy water. A lot of people get seasick pretty quick and that stuff. And, you know, that doesn't make for a very fun day for a lot of people. So if you fish the east coast of the island, like out in Nanaimo or that side, Campbell River, all the way up to Port Hardy, it's sheltered from the swell. You deal with wind, but you don't get the same roly-poly swell that makes everybody seasick. So there's different places you can go depending on your level of comfort. I think that are probably the key to the decision. The other one's probably just the state of the salmon right now, because it's a little tricky in some places and we've had some conservation issues and dwindling numbers. So you want to make sure you're picking, you know, the right time of year or the right place and time of year. It used to be really easy to catch salmon. It's not so easy anymore. You have to work for it.
Yeah, and I really want to talk about that here in a minute, but I also want to jump back to another thing that you said. It's like what kind of fish that, you know, you want to target. So like, let's just say, you know, for your average angler that gets out, you know, every second or third weekend here in Manitoba, what kind of fish would you suggest to like maybe target first to get that, you know, big water, big boat experience, and then maybe just kind of work your way up? Is that such a thing?
Yeah. I mean, there's five species of Pacific salmon. The Chinook is the prized salmon. It's the one everybody wants to catch. And it's the one that's, you know, having the largest conservation issues right now for a whole number of reasons. But these are the fish that run, you know, up to 50 and 60 pounds. And I mean, I've fought every kind of fish in all sorts of places over this world. There's not much that compares to fighting a 30 plus pound Chinook. It's called a Taiyi, and it can kick your ass. And it's just, as far as sport fish goes, it's one of the finest out there. Coho or smaller, that's maybe your second most popular fish, but they're jumpers. They're a lot more active. It's a different type of fish. They're more plentiful, so they're easier to catch typically. Then we're into chum salmon, pink. Those are tricky. You know, they don't eat so good, so people tend to avoid those. Salmon's traditionally been a meat fishery, right? Everybody likes to put them in their freezer and on their table. So certainly the Chinook and the Coho are your best eating fish. And it goes downhill from there with the other kinds. More and more, though, like you're seeing with the trouble in salmon and the fishery, there's a lot of people halibut fishing and ling cod and rockfish, and there's a booming bottom fishing industry. I guess there always has been, but with the shortness of salmon in places, or that's not a very good word, but the salmon not being one population, not what it once was, a lot more people are bottom fishing and not just trolling around looking for salmon.
One of the cool things that I got to do when I was on the boat with my buddy Andrew out there too is drop some spot prawn cages or traps out there. So we kind of drop some traps on the way out, fish for salmon all day, and then a little bit of ling cod fishing, and then we'd pick them up on the way in. And that was a nice little bonus at the end of the long day too.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of that. That's the West Coast combo for sure, right?
Yeah.
And it's the nice thing is you can do it everywhere, especially this time of year. We winter fish all year off the coast for winter feeder springs, Chinook. But they're hard to get. So you're putting in a bunch of hours in cold weather and everything, hunting down a few fish. But if you drop those traps at the start of the day and then pick them up on the way back in, you're getting your prawns and crabs sometimes too. And that's making for a pretty good harvest.
Nice.
But it's the West Coast classic for sure.
Do you ever hit any of the streams and the rivers for the spawning runs or anything like that?
Well, a lot of them are closed now with all the salmon troubles we're having. So there's not too much in river fishing like there used to be. And some of the steelhead rivers are in trouble too. I for sure used to a lot more, but I got a couple boys, 16-year-olds, who play a lot of hockey. So when I'm done trolling in October, I can't convince the wife to let me go fishing too much in the winter other than on my boat. So I think once they're a few years older, I'll get back to the river stuff because I like it a lot. But I don't get as much time as I'd like to there for sure.
Nice. Yeah, kids will definitely keep you busy. That's for sure.
Hockey stuff.
I got a bit of a question here for you. You've obviously got, a reputable amount of time in the industry here. And I'm interested to hear your perspective on how, like, have you noticed any change in, like, the movement of people in regards to social media and getting that extra exposure out there for sport fishing in BC?
Yeah, no question, right? Like, social media didn't really exist when we started the show 15 years ago. We had a website, so it's really come around in a massive way. You know, people predicted the demise of television for a long time here. Probably when we were starting the show back then, people said TV wasn't going to keep working. Lo and behold, it still is. But man, the social media has taken over so much of what we do and what operations do just to get the word out, right? So I think every year it seems to ramp up more and more, and there's more people across all the different social media platforms, and you know, more video out there, and mm-hmm. more fishing tools that are just going onto YouTube, and way more content, right? You never used to see or share information like people do now. And, you know, fishermen are pretty top secret a lot of the time too. So, you know, you start putting all your fish and your secrets out there on social media. The next thing you know, you're out fishing the next day and you got 10 guys on your tack. So you gotta be careful how you share that social media sometimes too.
Definitely can get, yeah, I know some guys out here, obviously we got the same style forms, for our lakes out here and stuff. And, you see them even a crack in the ice fishing window, you know, they got it blocked out and all pixelated so nobody can see the shoreline.
Oh yeah. Ice fishing hut special.
Love yeah, exactly.
But you've mentioned it a few times now, and I'm actually very interested. I don't know much about it, and I don't know how much Chase knows either, but maybe he can kick in a few questions. But, you know, the salmon regulations and some of the things that you've alluded to earlier, what's going on out there? And yeah, can you kind of fill us in with some of the news on the salmon?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk for hours and hours with what's going on, because nobody's got concrete answers for you, right? And that's DFO right through the industry. I'm actually working on an article for British Columbia Magazine. I still do a little feature writing on the side, and they wanted me to tackle that issue here for a fall issue. I got like 6 months to work on it. What's up with the salmon is essentially what the article is going to be. And I can't figure out where to start, man, because there's so many different problems that are existing. You know, the 10 years ago, the salmon population was so much more plentiful than it is right now, you know, and there's factors like global warming. There's the issue in the Fraser River. A lot of the streams and the habitat degradation and development are problems. We got the southern resident killer whales here in the southern Strait of Georgia and around Vancouver. I can't remember the number, but those things eat like 300 salmon a day. Don't hold me to that exact number, but they eat an absolute ton of salmon, and it's all they eat. They're picky eaters. So we were literally getting fisheries closed to save those salmon for the killer whales. And I think there's 65 in the southern pod. So that's an issue. Not everybody's a big whale fan either around here because of the salmon problems, but it's an iconic BC creature, right? So there's a lot of measurements out there to protect the southern resident killer whales. We've got a huge seal issue. Seals, pinnipeds, sea lions. Like, man, the last couple of weeks I've been fishing, I'm losing 50% of my fish to seals. So that never used to happen. Rarely would you get sealed 10 years ago. Certain tacks where they become habituated. But now in Vancouver Harbor, like, you're lucky if you can pull 40% of your fish out of there without a seal taking them, right?
So you're talking, hang on a second. You're talking, you're reeling in a fish and a seal comes and nabs it off the end of your line.
Oh yeah, and doesn't just nab it. Like, you're fighting one of these fish, and then all of a sudden your reel is screaming and your line is going a million miles an hour, because you can't fight a seal on a 30-pound test. That those things are strong and they're fast, right? So yeah, all of a sudden you go from fighting a decent fish to chasing down a mammal, and it's almost impossible. So it happens all the time, and there's a lot of people around here that aren't too happy about it. So it's one of the things certainly that people are calling on DFO to take some action on.
That's insane. I've never, that's the first time I've heard of this. And so you just said you take after them. So do you literally fire up the boat and try and retrieve whatever line you can, and then just cut her off whenever you see fit, or how does that work?
Yeah, you usually get your gear back. You know, you put a lot of pressure on them or whatever. I don't know why, but seldom do you actually lose your spoon or your flasher or whatever you got on the end of your line, which is funny. You'd think you would. I don't know how that works out. But yeah, they just take off. So you're holding on. And after a while, it pisses you off, right? If you're losing all your fish and spending all your time with these guys. So we tend to go after him now and then, or back the boat down and not give up quite so easily as some people might, just because you're seeing it all the time. So you put in a bit of a battle, and occasionally you get your fish back. Occasionally you get your gear back. So you don't always lose, but it's a real problem for sure. And it's not just us fishing either. Like these seals are all habituated around the river mouths, like the mouth of the Fraser. They know when the fish are spawning and around. They know when all the smolts and the fry are coming out of the river from the hatchery. So they're preying hard on a lot of the salmon. They're definitely something that's impacting our numbers right now.
Yeah. So they're getting them right as they're coming out of the hatchery and teeing everything up, man.
Yeah. They know what's going on. They're pretty habituated, and we'll get on certain tacks up and down the coast here. But typically when we're fishing big Chinook salmon, we're putting the boat right in close to the rocks. You're not fishing open water. We're in 50, 60 feet. We're trolling or even shallower if you can, but you're tight into rocks. That's where the big Chinook salmon like to hang out, and in the kelp beds. But in a lot of places, sea lions and seals have figured that out, because the fishermen are in the same places every year. Mm-hmm. So they become habituated. They just hang out on the rocks. You know, there's a bunch of places we fish where we joke that you don't want to be the first or second boat in there. You want to be the third, because the first two fish are always gone. You know, if somebody else goes in and gets cleaned out before you, then maybe you got a chance of pulling your fish out. So it's a pain for sure, but it's a state of the coast right now.
No kidding. I know, like I said, my buddy Andrew there, he often sends videos of like just sea lions that are either like just messing up docks or, you know, just stinking up the place kind of thing in certain areas too. So obviously it sounds like it's definitely an increased population issue or something going on there.
Yeah, there's a lot of argument over the numbers. It depends who you ask, I guess. You know, the fishermen are all, and Sport Fishing Institute and some of the people in our side of the world, there's a lot of talk about a pinniped or a seal cull that they actually need to go out and reduce the population by 50% or whatever that number is. They've talked about involving the First Nations and making it a food fishery and a commercially viable fishery for them. I guess it's not a fishery if it's mammals. It would be a hunt. But, you know, they've actually tested a bunch of the seal meat and sea lion meat and what have you to see if it's viable to harvest and sell. So there's definitely a realization that there's a problem out there, but I don't know if anything would ever be done about it. As you can imagine, the optics with a seal cull around Vancouver are not especially good. So that's not that would have a lot of support in some groups for sure.
Yeah, there's definitely a huge, I mean, BC's a real hotspot right now for that whole anti-hunting kind of movement and all that. So it'd be interesting, but they're it's good to hear that they're researching options to figure something out there. And I think the First Nations thing should be a good option in my mind.
But, yeah, I think so. Everybody's looking for an answer, right? So this is as hot as it gets right now. People are talking about this week. And again, everybody's waiting on our new fishing regulations April 1st, which, you know, they're going to take a lot of these things into consideration.
Yeah. So what did they change in the previous year here? I remember seeing some big stuff come out and some tighter dates, I think, and tighter keep.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. You know, it wasn't that long ago that, especially Chinook, you could keep four a day or you keep two a day and four in possession. That's all been changed. There's only a couple places where you have that kind of retention now. It got cut in half the last few years to one a day and two in possession. And then down here in the south, I'd mentioned those killer whale problems and what have you. They closed everything last year. So when we hit April 1st last year, everything in Vancouver, the mouths of the Fraser, the Gulf Islands, a huge chunk of the southern Strait of Georgia was closed to any salmon fishing. And no catch and release, no retention, no nothing. You weren't allowed to put a rod in the water. And you can imagine with those regulations coming out early April, that nobody had any warning or expected anything like that. There was so many guide operations and fishermen that got left hanging because of that decision. It was super tough, and that's the one we're waiting to hear the repeat on here come April 1st, if there's going to be anything different or what we're dealing with down here.
Man, talk about kicking a guy when they're down, eh? Hang COVID off them and then shut down their fishery for
Oh, yeah, it's crazy, right? Like, so many guys rely on those American, you know, clients too for the guiding businesses. It's always been big in British Columbia, getting the Californians and what have you in there. And, you know, there's lots of good sportsmen and fishermen down there that love to come up here. Well, you close the border off, and then all the fisheries closures on top of that. It's been a couple of really tough seasons for a lot of the guides, which is too bad, because, you know, the science dictates from everything I've researched and what a lot of knowledgeable people will tell you, that the science supports some retention and a fishery that they went too far last year. And I would share that thought.
That's super interesting. So you kind of mentioned the seals and the sea lions, whales. You also kind of touched on climate change. Do you have any perspective on, you know, what's changing? What are some of the, like, very noticeable signs that maybe you've seen in your career on the big water there?
Yeah, things have certainly changed. The water's warmed up, right? It might only be a few degrees from what it was 10 years ago, but the water's definitely warming. A few years ago, you guys might have heard about it in the news, but the blob pushed up north. You know, we're getting these crazy pockets of super warm water that's coming up from California and Mexico offshore of Vancouver Island. And they're affecting the whole ecosystem and the climate and weather patterns and currents. It's part of the reason our tuna fishery is actually doing pretty well, is because we're getting all this crazy warm water up here. So it's kind of a bonus to what many might look at as an ecological disaster. But, you know, there's a lot of people joking around now that we're going to be catching marlin and swordfish and big pelagics up here off Vancouver Island in the not too distant future. The water's warming up that much. So the water temperature would be a big one. There's a lot less kelp out there, you know, and I know just the general habitat for big Chinook salmon isn't what it used to be. So there's a couple of main issues right there.
Yeah, that's totally interesting. It's kind of crazy, because we've always talked about, you know, just the other little things that we've noticed. We've had maybe a lot shorter time, you know, in the outdoors. There's a lot of people out that get outside, but, you know, like, even just with climate change and stuff, some of the things that we've been noticing, like with the migration of waterfowl and, you know, certain things here and there. And it's kind of interesting to me, just because I don't get out to the coast. I don't know much about, you know, the coastal type fishing, that, you know, it is obviously an issue, and it's just, you know, it's about adapting and changing and trying to, you know, trying to fix it the best way we can possible. But yeah, that's super interesting. The other thing I was going to ask you too, is I know you kind of touched on it with the sea lions and the seals and stuff, but the whales. So there's really no, like, there's no argument, like, there's no battle against the whales. Like, the whales are going to eat all these salmon, and in that area, everyone loves the whale, right? Like, there's nothing you can really do. Like, it's basically a case closed. They get the first shot.
You pretty much summed it up right there. Yeah.
Yeah. They're okay.
Iconic species down here, right? So, you know, killer whales kind of trump everything else. And not even too many people would necessarily argue with that. I mean, there's a lot of people that think DFO put the closures in the wrong place, where the killer whales aren't, or they don't feed the, you know, so there's some things like that haven't been nailed down maybe the way they should be. And I'm no expert on whales. I'll say I do see them a lot, but the conservation side of things they're really concerned about that southern resident pod. Those 65 whales are some of the most watched and visible creatures on the coast. And that goes right down to Seattle and Puget Sound. They run up through Vancouver. They're the ones all around the lower mainland that people will see. They're your iconic whales. So if they need more salmon, people are going to find a way to hopefully find them for them. The fishermen will come second, right? And that's, I don't think too many fishermen would even complain about that, right? Nobody wants to see the killer whales gone, right? But hopefully we can see better management measures out of DFO, and people get their act a little more in gear.
Yeah, no kidding. Is there?
Yeah, exactly.
So besides the, you know, the research into, like, some population control for seals and sea lions and stuff like that, are they doing any other measures for, you know, to help increase Chinook numbers by anything with the hatcheries or stuff like that?
Yeah, there's a ton of work going on the hatchery side, more and more all the time. There's one in southern Vancouver Island out of the Souk area, And it's one of the specific main feeding areas for those killer whales. And they're trying to pump more Chinook out of there essentially to feed the whales. So there's a lot of measures like that. I work on a hatchery up the coast in Rivers Inlet each fall, and it produces the biggest salmon pretty much left on Earth. So we get the absolute huge river monsters and invest a ton of time in the hatchery program. And there's a lot of people volunteering up and down the coast. DFO cut almost all its funding years ago to the hatchery program. It's a shadow of what it used to be, which is super unfortunate because it's got a real good impact here in British Columbia. We, in fact, rely on the American hatcheries a lot. Washington's doing a really good job pumping out hatchery fish, and we catch a lot of them down here in the Georgia Strait and Vancouver.
No kidding. It seems to be a bit of a common theme in the environmental world right now. Is like 10, 15 years ago, things just started getting cut, and now you're kind of seeing the a lot of the effects of some of that stuff that, you know, could have been helping out a long ways.
Yeah, nobody seemed to think about it maybe back then, you know, because there was more fish, but the impact it's had, you know, those cuts is substantial. So hopefully we'll see a little more money back in there. It'd be nice.
No kidding. I'm kind of interested to see, like, you talked a little bit about the, you know, the guys that are being affected by COVID and this fishery shutdown, but I'm kind of interested to hear like what the state of things are like over there for operators, for charter operators, you know.
There was a lot of charter operators for a long time, and I mean, you could probably argue there was too many on the coast. The individual operators, for the most part, the good ones seem to be doing all right. Again, there's this last year or two has been tough, but I think we've seen a general decrease in the number of lodges that are out there. There used to be a lot more lodges up and down the coast, and there's a number of reasons for that. A lot of it's Great Bear Rainforest and First Nations territory, and people aren't renewing leases and what have you. So that's a little bit different for sure. Yeah, interesting question. Really, you know, stumps me every day, to be honest.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of factors there that that kind of, you know, keep things flowing and going.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that's definitely changed, the fishery as a whole used to be a complete meat fishery. You know, it wasn't as sport-based. It's become more experiential now. People are doing more catch-and-release type programs. You know, the big tahi and big salmon we're chasing, usually you release them. They don't eat that good anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, you're better 15-pound fish than a 40-pound salmon. It's like cooking a great big salmon roast half the time. But a lot of the time, these are our big females that we need to get back into the river to spawn too. So there's definitely more of a conservation angle underfoot. People are looking at things differently on the water, and you're seeing less of a complete total meat hunt out there. Which it has been on the coast for a long time. And I mean, these are great eating fish. I got a freezer full, a couple of freezers actually, and we eat fish all year. But it's not what it used to be in terms of the lodges and the experiences. You can't just go in for 3 days and load up on the easy number of fish that you used to be able to. They're just not out there like they were. So the lodge experience, I think, has generally changed from what it used to be.
Yeah. How do I frame this one? The quality of that meat though is just second to none. We eat some salmon here back in Manitoba, but the stuff I brought home from the West Coast there in my cooler when I was fishing is just, you can't really compare it to anything else. So it's I don't know, if I'm going out there, I'm hoping to bring a couple back. That's for sure.
That's a big part of it, right? Some of the finest eats out there, right? And I think any good guide or fisherman, anyone that's into it, they love eating the salmon. It's part of what we do, right?
Yeah.
Same goes for the halibut and the ling cod. We got a bunch of good eating fish, so we won't even bring the tuna up on that front. But the nice thing about the tuna, we don't have the same kind of regulations. The limit's 20 a day a person. Oh. So, you know, your two-man crew, we've done it the last couple of years where we maxed out. We brought 40 tuna back in, all in the 20-pound range, right? So we'll work 10 hours a day, and we might get a Chinook or two, but a full-day tuna fishing, and you can absolutely load her up.
No kidding. That makes that 100-mile trip well worth it.
Yeah, man, if you're burning your $1,000 in gas, you know, you want to come home with some fish for sure. So it's well worthwhile.
No doubt. You know, we've been kind of immersed in conservation talk of mainly Chinook salmon here for the last little bit. And I feel like we would be doing a bit of a disservice to this conversation if we didn't speak on like the little bit of the life cycle of this fish. And correct me if I'm wrong, I've done a little bit of research into it, but obviously you'd know a lot better than I would. But most of those big fish that are headed up to spawn, they're only a few years old, right? The Chinook salmon don't really live very long, correct?
No, the average span's 5 years. So the biggest fish we're catching out there in the ocean are 5 or 6 year fish. And sometimes we get 4 year fish going up the rivers, depending on the genetic stock and which river it is. But the big, big, big fish are 5 and occasionally 6 year fish. They don't last longer than that. They're back to the river and spawning and dying out after that. So you won't get older salmon at all. And the nice thing is, you know, with mercury levels and stuff in the water and everything, that's better. If you get a fish that's only ocean for 5 years as opposed to some that's been out there for 40, they're pretty clean fish. It's healthy eating, right? So it's that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I guess if you look at that from a conservation perspective too, if you hop on any issues soon enough, ideally, you know, in 5 or 6 years, hopefully you could see a really big impact on what you've been doing for that fishery.
Yeah, I think that's the idea with the closures when they lock them down, right? Is they know there's going to be a 5 year period before you really see any effect, because it's whatever we do with this year's fish or this year's hatchery, you're not really seeing the results of that for 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So you have to work that far in advance almost to try to fix the problems just with the life cycle of the fish. So that's for sure one of the challenges.
Yeah. I think one of the super interesting part about the Chinook salmon too is that, well, probably most of all the salmon, is that they, after spawning, they actually spend a year or two in freshwater before they come out of the rivers too, right?
Not after, they die after they spawn.
No, I mean, the hatchlings, right?
Yeah, they're all a little bit different. Some species will be lake bound and spend more time in freshwater. Some will stay in the river longer. Some take off right out into the salt chuck quick. So it totally depends on the species and the genetic strain. They all act a little bit different for sure, which probably doesn't make things easier for DFO or everyone involved, right? There's no cooking cutter for this one. Every region and every river is a little bit different. So that's a challenge.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that kind of makes me wonder, you know, after talking about some of these regulations and the closures and stuff, like, so what can an angler do, not only from the West Coast, but anybody like across, whoever's listening, like, where can they find information on this stuff? You know, is there anything they can do or any kind of groups they can look into if they want to, like, you know, participate or put in some sort of action on their own behalf?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. The Pacific Salmon Foundation is probably our biggest charitable organization, and they fund a lot of the hatchery programs and a lot of the conservation efforts around salmon and education and what have you. So that would be one of the bigger bodies. The Sport Fishing Institute kind of represents the public fishery and a lot of us fishermen's use and their take, and you know, the same exists for commercial and what have you. But that Pacific Salmon Foundation is probably a key one. And then, you know, DFO provides their information on the closures and everything as well. So there's a few different ways to get it for sure.
Yeah, right on. And then, and what about yourself? You said you're doing a little bit of writing here coming up in the fall. You're doing a lot of fishing. What else have you got going on?
We're pretty busy with our production company. I do a ton of stuff in the Great Bear Rainforest, which would be north of Vancouver quite a bit for you guys that don't know out there. But it's basically from Prince Rupert down to the northern tip of Vancouver Island. And it's a crazy wild place. There's not a lot of development up there. It's mostly First Nations. There's a couple small communities. But it's one of the last wild places out there on Earth, and I spend as much time as I can there. I help out in the tourism end and work with a few of the First Nations, and we fish a ton up there because, you know, you're fishing by yourself or with a couple boats as opposed to, you know, down here in Vancouver. Opening day last year, September 1st, after those closures, 300 boats on the South Arm of the Fraser. Never seen anything like it. So, yeah, it's not as remote down here, but up there it certainly is. So we love that region. The north is incredible. We spend a bunch of time up towards Alaska too. We couldn't cross the border last year because of all the closures, but there's some giant halibut up that way. So it's pretty cool to get your Alaska license and be able to bust up across the border when you're there.
Man, you cover some miles in that boat, don't you?
Oh man, it's called Big Coast for a reason. I think we, 24 grand in fuel. And it's, miles plus to get up to Prince Rupert from here in Vancouver, running the whole BC Inside Passage. So it's one of the things we started doing just to set our show apart. You know, there's a lot of fishing shows out there. There's a lot of not good fishing shows out there, a lot of crap. We never really wanted to play in that ballpark, so to speak, right? We'd done production at a pretty high level before, so we try to set ourselves apart and show people what the coast is. So we're not just slaying fish and being yahoos all the time. We're doing some pretty serious boat travel and trying to teach people, you know, about doing that safely and showing it off too. And we try to keep it light and keep it entertainment too, man. There's a lot of fishing shows out there that are trying to teach you everything about fishing. I like to think that most of our audience knows how to fish. And we're not here to teach them lessons, you know. You can figure shit out on your own for the most part, but, you know, we're here to entertain. Our show's about entertainment and showing off a beautiful place, so it's how we try to position it.
Tim, you gotta tell me the distance you travel there again. I lost you on my end here for a second, and I don't think I got that on the...
Sure. Yeah, we run BC Inside Passage, so from Vancouver up to Prince Rupert, which is essentially your whole British Columbia coast. You're about 600 miles.
Man.
So... You know, and we've done that in 2 days just to run the boat up there. So the whole idea is that's where the salmon fishing gets hot first is up north. They have different runs up there on the Skeena and Nass rivers and what have you than we do in the south. So end of April and May, fishing up there is starting to heat up already. And we basically follow the fish down the coast from Prince Rupert. Once we start hitting them up there, you know, through June, July, and August, the fishing gets better as you go south. So, you know, by the time we get down here to Vancouver in the fall, you know, the fishing's pretty much finished off first couple of weeks of September. And, you know, we've run it out since May, and that's all you can do with salmon. And then we kick it to tuna for a couple of weeks and go hang out. But it's a long way to run, but it's pretty cool following the fish. And it was kind of the premise we built the show on.
Put that on my bucket list, man. That's awesome.
I was just going to say, does Big Coast have any internships? Like that would take some Manitobans.
Yeah, we don't ever get asked that one. Although I had a super funny message on my Instagram last week from a lady who said she was 74 years old and she was the keenest fisherwoman ever, and she was literally giving me crap. Like it was a hard email telling me that I had to take her out fishing, and she was getting all this, and her husband didn't fish with her the last bunch of years, and then he passed away, but I had to take her fishing. So. Haven't yet, but maybe I'll take her up on it.
Yeah, but you talked about Big Coast here a little bit. You want to tell us a bit about it? I think you said in the intro, maybe we weren't recording yet, but you're working on your 14th year. Is that a kind of like a family run production, or like who's all on your team? What do you guys do, and where can you find that TV show?
Yeah, we're definitely a boutique family production. You know, I've had the same editor. We edit the show up in Whistler, but I've had the same editor for 25 years now. So the two of us have worked together for a long time. My 16-year-old boys are deckhands now. They were useless when we started the show. They were still in diapers and stuff. It's pretty funny. They've grown up with it, and they're helping out. But because we cover so many miles, you know, that it's a big chunk of coast. I got a few pro staff guys. Up and down the coast, probably a half dozen in total. So when I'm in Prince Rupert, I'll fish with Travis McNeese. When I'm in the Great Barrier Rainforest or somewhere else, I have a couple guys there that I fish with or what have you. So I've kind of developed a pretty good team over the years and some infrastructure. We got some cabins and places we stop and everything to make a a real logistically challenging trip possible, right? Without a few good people in the right place, we could never do this. So it's definitely a cool team effort, you know, and to be doing it for this long, it's 15 years, really. The only year we didn't do it was that Olympic year, because I was traveling all over the world coaching snowboarding and could not fish at all. So, and we've really been at it hard for 15 years, and every year we just keep trying to do it better and better, you know, better cameras, bigger trips. You know, the minute you stop progressing or pushing it, I think that'll be the time we pack it all in.
That's incredible, man. What's the longest stint on the road that you generally go on in a given season?
You know, a few months, pretty much. That whole trip, you know, we'll head up to Prince Rupert in the spring. I'll cheat it a little bit, you know, like I'll tell you 3 months, but I might leave the boat in Prince Rupert for a week and fly home and see the family. Mm-hmm. We'll do that a couple times, you know. If I go too hard, I find out, you know, you absolutely kick the hell out of yourself. You break stuff, you lose stuff. You got to regroup here and there. So I take a couple weeks off during the season as we're working our way down with the boat. Just to try to keep it all together and take a break so we can do good work. You can definitely burn yourself out. She's a grind.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man.
That's where the Budweiser and potato chips come in, though, right?
Yeah. It's a full circle on this podcast episode. Let me tell you that for free. But yeah, that's super cool. And, you know, we're not going to probably take up too much more of your time. It's been an unreal kind of talking, and you know, obviously it'd be nice to get you back on. I have a lot more questions. We could probably talk for hours about this, but I don't think you did mention where we can find your TV show. Is it on YouTube? Is it on like cable or satellite? Like, where can we find that?
Right on. Well, across Canada you'll find it on the Sportsman Channel. Here in British Columbia we have a bunch of stations. It's on Czech TV, CKPG, CFJC, Chat. So there's a bunch of Western-based networks. We're across the United States on World Fishing Network. We don't put too much online yet because we're still actually doing a bunch of distribution, and I'm selling the stuff worldwide trying to make a few bucks. We just put a couple series into New Zealand for the first time, so that's kind of cool. And we'll try to do a little bit more of that distribution. We're also cranking things up to 4K. We've been filming the 4K for a few years, but we haven't actually produced it and pumped it out there in 4K. So just another way we can kind of leave a few of these crappier fishing shows behind, hopefully, is put stuff out at a really high level and get some 4K out there. Because the beautiful shots we get from the drones and all that stuff, it lends itself to some high quality production, right? So it's cool. It's a passion doing it well.
No kidding.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done you know, a little bit of work out in BC as a tree planter back in my day, and I just know the pure beauty and being in those mountainsides and everything else. Like, I couldn't imagine being able to work out there every single day. Chase, do you have anything else to let's just do the round table, I guess, now, if you have any more questions or anything for Tim, and we'll go to Tim and then we'll wrap her up.
Yeah, I think we just, Tim, why don't you tell everyone where to find you on your social platforms and to connect with you?
Yeah, I can do that, I think. Big Coast on Instagram for sure. Really Big Coast on Twitter. Big Coast page on Facebook under my name, Tim Milne. YouTube channel in development. Like I said, we haven't put too much online. There's one out there, but I got to be careful. I can't put more than like 2 or 3 minute chunks out. So we'll have a new YouTube channel pretty quick, though, where we'll air some of the vintage stuff. You know, once you got 160 plus episodes, you can go back a long way. And the cool thing is, man, I'm 15 years younger back then, right? So do TV forever that way.
That's awesome. Well, final on my end, Tim, thanks a lot for coming on, man. Chatting with you just sounds like an amazing adventure that your entire life has been, and it's inspiring, to say the least, for me anyways, and I hope it inspires a lot of other people. And I think you know, it's also making me want to get back out west in the worst way and hit the water, whether it's on the salt water or fly fishing a stream or just camping in the wilderness somewhere out there. So thanks for that, Tim.
Oh, absolutely, man. Thanks.
Yeah, and before I'd like to actually, I can barely talk right now. Yeah, but before we let you go, I'd just like to, you know, also kind of echo what Chase has said. But I also just want to, like, just let you know, like, we really appreciate you coming on. You know, it was one of those things that we're looking to get somebody from the coast, you know, the coastal fishing, coastal angling type of episode for our podcast this year. And it was one thing that we wanted to put on our kind of like our bucket list. And I know it took a little bit of time to kind of get it organized with scheduling and stuff. So I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your thoughts. You know, like it's one thing just to have a conversation, but when you start diving into some of like the issues that you guys are having, like with the salmon and stuff, I really appreciate the information that you've provided tonight. So thank you very much for coming on the show. But that's all we got on my end, unless you got anything else, Tim.
It's right on, Gus. It was good chatting, and I definitely like spreading the word here. You know, it's what we do out here, a bunch of us. And Willie Mitchell, who's out in Tofino there, and he's an ardent tuna fisherman after his hockey retirement, he'll tell you to live your passion, right? That's his big thing. And he's just crazy out there chasing tuna. And, you know, it gets deep into your blood after a while. The salt water does run in your veins. So it's what we do. And I tell you, this is a good year for anybody to come out to BC, because if there's no Americans coming up across the border, there's a whole lot of open spots with some great guides and good lodges. So there's affordable opportunities that wouldn't normally be there this coming season for people to come visit BC, right? So we'd like to have everybody out fishing, man. Come check her out.
Yeah, it's going to be right onto that list again, the things to do. All right, Tim, well, you enjoy your night, and we'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Cheers, guys.
Well, wasn't that awesome? I'm super pumped to have Tim Millen on. He was actually really fun to talk to, and I can't wait to have him on again. One thing I do want to say in this outro before we take off is I'm going to call out a previous guest, a good friend of ours, Dell Barber. Dell, if you're listening to this, you need to get on your horse. You should know what I'm talking about.
Here we go.
Those are fighting words. Tristan, what's new in the store?
We have a sale on hats and tees at the moment. Or did that end? No, that's still on.
She's still rolling. 25% off select hats and tees in the store right now.
What else is new, Sheldon?
Yeah, in the store, not much. We've got our decals are all there. All our gray and black hoodies are now restocked. I believe I'm going to have to check with Chase when he picks it up, but I believe our double XL hoodies are on back order. And that's going to happen probably throughout the summer with a bunch of our stock, is that back orders are still happening because of COVID restrictions and stuff in factories, I guess. So, please be patient with us. If there's anything that you do want that you don't see in the store, please send us an email or DM us on Facebook or Instagram. If you aren't following us on Facebook or Instagram, check us out. It's Panoramic Outdoors on both platforms. Again, check out our YouTube platform. Can I say platform any more times here? Check out our YouTube and subscribe if you can. And if you're listening to this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to it, give us a comment, rate us, and like, share. Do whatever you can to help us grow. We've got a lot of cool guests here in April coming up. So thanks to everyone that's been tuning in.
Right on. Well, Tristan, you got anything else, buddy?
Yep. Just note that any Panoramic Outdoors endorsed platform will only have one R, well, two R's if you count the outdoor part. And we will not be asking you for your credit card information over social media. If that's it, you best keep your lines tight and edge on your blade, powder dry. And what's the last one there, Sheldon?
Take the tabs off your beer cans and donate to wheelchairs.
That's a good one, actually.